And I want the rest of you cowboys to know something. There's a new sheriff in town.
Dear Uncle Sam,
my name is John Q. Public, and I am a member in good standing of an organization called America, and I have a message for those agencies and agents that work under the auspices of the Department of Justice. You have called me many things in the past: rebel, right-wing extremist, domestic terrorist, to name a few, but that is not important. What I'm about to tell you is... There must be accountability in all things, sooner or later. When you sin, however big or small, you will be held accountable, either in this life or the next. When you invade people's privacy, violate their rights, steal property, break up families, and hurt people, the time is fast approaching that you will be held accountable both in this life and the next. You and I took the same oath, administered by the same people. We both swore to protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Some of you actually feel that you honor that oath, but you violate it each time you force a young girl to her bedroom floor in nothing but her underwear and hold her there at gunpoint. Or when you shoot or stomp a family pet to death, or shoot a young boy down in cold blood in the mountains of Idaho, or incinerate over 70 innocent people in a church in Texas. Warriors indeed. How dare you call me a domestic terrorist? I go to work every day, sometimes at two jobs to make ends meet. I attend church every Sunday that I'm not working. As difficult as it is, I try to make time each day for my kids. I teach them about the Constitution and the Golden Rule. I have extra food and supplies to help myself and others through hard times. I try as hard as I can to obey the ever-increasing number of laws that are forced upon us, and I pay my fair share of taxes. I have a gun to protect myself and my family against those who would do us harm. I shouldn't have to use it to protect us against you. In fact, your organization is not even authorized by the Constitution and shouldn't be here. But since you are here, let's talk about your job description and performance. We have common enemies, you and I, that we should be united in fighting. The Founding Fathers never intended for us to fight each other. We should be as one. The current us-against-them attitude should never have been allowed to rear its ugly head. Division is unhealthy for the country. You will undoubtedly conduct more unconstitutional invasions of homes and businesses, and more innocent people will be injured or killed. A dairy in Pennsylvania, a rabbit grower in Kansas, a gun shop in New Mexico. It may even be me and my family. But let me make one thing abundantly clear. We, the people, have grown weary of living in fear. We're tired of being treated like animals. If you continue to follow the path that you are on, the time may come when you will not find us waiting to be descended upon when we least expect it. We may come to you. We outnumber you 1,000 to 1, and the same people that trained you trained many of us. We, the people, are becoming aware of those numbers. One day, you will launch one of your cowardly sneak attacks on an unsuspecting young family in Idaho, and instead of your brave sniper finding a defenseless, unarmed woman holding a baby in her arms, he may find that the tables have been turned. One day, instead of terrorizing and destroying another American family in retribution for a trivial infraction of an unconstitutional law, instead of shooting down defenseless children or young veterans that are trying only to live the American dream, you may find patriots waiting for you that have been pushed to their limit. One day, you will find that you have awakened a sleeping giant, and we, the people, will indeed hold you accountable for your evil deeds. Hundreds of men, women, and children have died at your hand because of poor information, no information, or just plain overzealous, out-of-control power freaks on an adrenaline high that have no regard for human life. Agents that think their badge is a license to kill with impunity. The difference between you and us is that we will not harm your family as long as they stay out of the fight. I don't want your family to go through what you have put many of ours through. Yes, they will be sad if you don't come home, but when the grieving is over, they will come to understand that you simply chose the wrong side. You see, this is nothing more than a conflict between good and evil. It's that simple, but this is not how it is supposed to be. This is not the America that the Founding Fathers entrusted us with. I implore each of you, before you go to work tomorrow, to take a long, hard look at yourself in the mirror and see if you truly like what you see. If you can look at yourself and be proud of what you've done, or what you may be called upon to do, or more importantly, if you feel that you can walk uprightly before God and look Him in the eye and feel justified in what you have done, then we have nothing further to discuss. But some of you are not really jackbooted thugs. Some of you are simply misguided and feel that you really are doing the right thing. To you, I say, please, follow your conscience. Do what you know in your heart is right, for we the people will hold you accountable. Guns, or if you don't believe our government is corrupt enough to compare to 1938 Nazi Germany, this may not be the show for you, because for the next 2 hours, that's all we're going to talk about. You need to understand that there's a storm coming. You need to understand that the storm is building strength. And most of all, you need to understand that we are the storm. Yes, we are, and it's becoming increasingly more urgent that we make that known. Welcome to the Shooting Bench. It's the 17th of June. It is a Monday. And I apologize for Friday night. I had intended to go live, and things happened and just didn't work out. So, but the Tinker is always on top of things and always takes care of things for me. So, the Tinker, thank you so much for that. Let me go over here and look at the chat room, see if anybody's there. And, hey, somebody is there. How about that? Tebow and Nan and Pumpkin Cat. And, Tinker and Anonymous. All right. Good. I'm glad you guys showed up. Tonight is, it's basically going to be rant night. And I'll get to the rant here in just a little bit. I'm going to start out with a little bit of good news, and then I'm going to tear that all to pieces and stomp it into the ground and forget you ever heard it. But there are some good things that's happened out there. And because one of my programs happens to be messing up right now, I've got to pull some of this off my phone. So let me find it here. Okay, here we go. This is possibly one of the most awesomest stories I've heard in some time. And like one of my friends said on Facebook, people can be awesome once in a while if they just will. This is a story, and some of you read it already on my Facebook page. But there's a guy here that his daughter was getting married. And unbeknownst to everyone else, he wanted her stepfather to be recognized in this wedding as well. He said, after all, the stepdad had helped raise her. So when it came time to walk his daughter down the aisle, Brittany was her name, he did something that was completely unexpected, completely out of the norm there. He stopped the procession and run up to the front row and grabbed the girl's stepdad in order to share the honor of walking their daughter down the aisle. And I guess the stepdad was just
completely unaware of all this, and the photographer hit it just right where the two of them are. The dad went back here and grabbed the stepdad by the hand and went up to the front row and grabbed him and was heading back. And the guy, the stepdad, just obviously has just fallen apart. He was completely taken by surprise. This. So it said pretty much everybody. The bride was crying. The stepdad was crying. I mean, it was just a really awesome show of what's the right word? Compassion, maybe, and or just, you know, humanness. I don't know what the exact right word is for it, but he come and grabbed his hand, and the dad said, "You worked as hard as I have. You'll help us walk our daughter down the aisle." That is a real man right there. That's something that a whole hell of a bunch of men that I know would not have even remotely considered. The guy said, the stepdad said, "I got weak in the knees and I just lost it." He says, "Nothing better in my life. Most impactful moment in my life." I can't even imagine. If I'd have been there, I'd have cried. But anyway, he said, "For me to thank him for all the years of helping raise our daughter wouldn't be enough." The biological dad said that, and he said, "There's no better way to thank anybody than to ask him to assist me walking her down the aisle." That is this week's most awesomest post, maybe even this whole year. I don't know. Great story. All right, let me now, I had another one of good news. Don't get too used to this good news stuff, okay? That's not it, and that's not it, and that's not it. Because I have some other news here. I saw where they found this is not the story I'm looking for, but I saw where they found a perfectly preserved Ice Age wolf head in Siberia. They had, for whatever reason, gone into this ice thing and found it. They said it's 40,000 years old, is what they say, they figure it's about 25% larger than today's largest wolves. So that was that could have been a problem. That was a force to be reckoned with, 25% larger than our wolves now. Okay, well, I don't see this other story, so we'll just get on with the other news then. There was a little bit of good news here before we start, where the Supreme Court handed a victory to the Oregon baker that refused the gay wedding cake. And on the outside, that sounds pretty good. However, hey, Frog, glad you made it in there, brother. And WMD Doc, who else we got there? Anyway, I'm glad you guys made it. So where did WMD Doc go? I saw somebody say hi to him, but I don't see. Oh, there he is. Okay. All right. Good deal. This is not as good a news as everybody thinks it is. It's not bad news, but it's not as great as one would think. The Supreme Court did the same thing with a Washington florist, and the Washington court said that they got it right when they fined the florist, so nothing changed. And so likely, and Chris Ann Hall thinks the same thing's going to happen to this Oregon baker. It's not a victory. You know, if people would take the time to understand how the Supreme Court of the United States works, before they go out there and write all these articles espousing the glory of the Supreme Court and justice and the American way and all that stuff. So, Chris Ann Hall says this was a procedural no-brainer punt for the Supreme Court. Nothing really monumental. So we'll see. I see you there now, WMD Doc. Thank you for joining us. But we'll see what happens. But I don't expect it's going to be what everybody thought it was. So just stand by for that. Okay. Now, I want to start tonight's main part of tonight's show with something that someone that most of you don't remember. Tebow remembers, and Doc remembers. WMD Doc might. But once upon a time, there was a senator in the United States named Joe McCarthy. And Joe McCarthy was unquestionably the most unjustly demonized senator ever to be in the Capitol. Possibly the most the most demonized person, period, ever. He was the Lavoie Finicum of the 1950s. He stood against unbelievable persecution and ridicule and humiliation and threats, and he was finally censured from the Senate. And he died in the early 50s, and yeah, they say he possibly died. He was 48 years old. Possibly died from the effects of alcoholism. He actually was censured from the Senate in 1954, and he died a few years after that, but he was 48 when he died. His big deal was trying to get people to, that's right, Tebow. McCarthy was absolutely right. And that's something that people still don't want to accept, but some of us do. McCarthy devoted his entire time, well, he was in the Senate, pretty much his entire adult life, even before he was in the Senate, in attempting to make people understand and believe that the Communist Party was not only alive and well, but flourishing in the United States of America. And the what we would call the 3% of the day, which was probably only about 0.03% of the day, very few people really got on board with him. There was some. But understand where we were at in the 50s and 60s. Coming out of World War II, you know, God bless America, mom, apple pie, baseball, the whole thing. You know, we believed everything that the government told us. We believed that whatever they said, most of us eat it up because we were unquestionably patriotic at the time. Even if there are not a lot of people that, well, there were a lot of people that proved it. This was a time when people were coming out of a war where they were lying about their age at 13, 14, 15 years old, 16 years old to get into the military and fight the communists and fight the enemy, knowing full well that a great many of them were not going to come home. And that's not the case anymore. There may be a few that do that, but if you look at the numbers, you know, it was hard for anybody to swallow what Joe McCarthy said. And the John Birch Society. Yeah, John Birch Society, that was, I think, came along shortly after McCarthy, but same deal. And people that belonged to the John Birch Society have been demonized, ridiculed, and persecuted simply for being a member of that organization. But they they kept going. They kept it together for, I know it was difficult for them. But. So right now, today, in 2019, actually probably started just a few years ago, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, Joe McCarthy is being looked at in a different light. He's being vindicated right now. They have proved, not only do they suspect or think that they agree now, they have proven beyond a doubt that the stuff that he was saying in the 1950s was right. Some of you remember some things I've played by one of the former presidents of the LDS Church named Ezra Taft Benson. He said the same thing. And looking at it from my standpoint, from looking at what Ezra Taft Benson said, I can absolutely guarantee you that was a fact. There was a term coined at the time called McCarthyism. And McCarthyism was something that was that his critics had come up with, which to them was the practice of making unjust accusations of disloyalty to the country, and especially the pro-communist activity and whatnot. And so even the I'm looking at this story, it says even the historians who investigate and expose Soviet espionage penetration of the U.S. government claim that McCarthy's charges were in fact based on thin evidence that he'd used for anti-communism, that he used anti-communism for partisan purposes. That was not why he used it. Senator McCarthy, I think, was a great American. And regardless of whether or not alcoholism killed him or he was murdered, he died thinking that basically the whole world, or at least the whole United States, was against him. But he never flinched from his stand. Finally, after sent some FBI agents that were chasing Soviet spies at the time, all joined in this criticizing. He said, one of them said, I was more interested in countering the activities of the Soviet KGB and GRU. McCarthy's star chamber proceedings, his lies and overstatements hurt our counterintelligence efforts. However, due to a great deal of evidence that's been accumulated since then, from a number of sources, including Soviet archives, since the end of the Cold War in 1990, shows that his charges, McCarthy's charges, were in many cases neither false nor hysterical, but absolutely correct. How did he know in 1950 what most of us are just learning in the last few years here? I'd like to know how that came about. What McCarthy said at the time, they say to assess McCarthy accurately at the time, the murderously evil nature of communism, the massive Soviet espionage, massive Soviet espionage penetration in the United States government, and the specifics of numerous cases regarding McCarthy's efforts to expose that espionage. So this thing is not all about Senator McCarthy. I just want you to think about that as we go into some of the rest of this stuff right now. This has been a long time coming. They've been working on it for a while. And to not believe this is to firmly have your head in the sand, or have your head somewhere where the sun doesn't shine. At this point in history, there is absolutely no denying this fact. And another thing that Ezra Taft Benson said, and I'm just paraphrasing, I don't remember the exact wording of it, but he said that something to the effect of, like Gulliver, if we would have taken the strings off of us one at a time as they were applied, we could have stopped this. But we've become so entangled in this massive number of strings and ropes and chains now that we can't hardly stand up. For instance, look at what they're doing in Oregon. Now, we could spend 9 days talking about what they're doing in Oregon, between gun stuff and drugs and homosexual stuff and crapping in the streets and whatever. We can go on and on. But that's all stuff that, and this is too, as a matter of fact, is being pushed on the people. But I looked at a bill coming up here. It's already passed, actually. A bill to increase fees for rafts, kayaks, and drift boats has passed the Oregon legislature. I understand why they want you to get a license for boats and stuff. I don't agree with it, but I understand. Where they can kind of have some kind of control when someone, you know, whatever, breaks the law or hurts somebody or whatever. But paddle boats? You know, you got to have a license even for a canoe, at least here in Arizona. I don't know about everywhere else. Legislation would require adults to purchase a $17 permit before floating a raft, kayak, or other non-motorized boat in Oregon has passed the state legislature. Senate Bill 47 now goes to the desk of who? Who's that? Kate Brown. Do you think she'll pass it? If you think she won't, you're crazy as hell. Or sign it, I mean. It passed the Senate 20-7 and the House 36-24. It required boats 10 feet long and longer. A new permit would be required for boats 10 feet long and longer beginning in 2020. And then there's some other stipulations here. So, we are taxed, licensed for fees and permits and stuff till hell won't have it, till we can't see straight. Now, to go along with this, what we're trying to make well known here. Yeah, DeTinker. I knew DeTinker would remember Joe McCarthy as well. And I'm preaching to the choir, as always, because I know pretty much all of y'all believe this. And when this hits the podcast, you know, there'll be several hundred more that will listen to it. And I would imagine that some of those are on board, but maybe younger and still trying to absorb some of the things that happened in my childhood. Actually, it was even a little bit before, started a little before my childhood. To go along with that, You know, we heard how many people have suicided themselves, or how many people were suicided, let's put it that way. How many people were suicided that were related in some fashion to either the Clintons or Obama or both? Well, there's a new one, 58 years old. He was the economic aide to both Clinton and Obama. He was, now he, this may be perfectly legitimate. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I'm just saying it's a little odd that yet another person has committed suicide. This guy was found dead Saturday in his home. 58 years old. It just seems strange to me that it happened right now. That's just something for you to think about. Look at all different levels of government. Tucson, Arizona. Arizona has a well thought out, not too long ago passed statute that says that cities, counties, state, whatever, cannot destroy guns that have been confiscated or found or whatever, stolen by people that steal guns, like the ATF. Well, that's federal, so that wouldn't count anyway. But just to show how every level of government is becoming, not everywhere and not all of them, but we've talked so many times about people that have, or governments that have done things completely opposed to what the law says or what they're supposed to. They look at the sanctuary cities and in Tucson here, they said they've destroyed thousands of guns since 2013. 2013, I believe, is when that law was passed. In that, you know, they, of course, they go and do background checks and they check and see, you know, make sure that everything is on the up and up before they do that. But in 2013, they collected almost 2,000 guns. 244 of those were auctioned off. And that's what the law says, that these guns, if they are of significant value, what's the word that they use? Let's see if I can find it here. There's a phrase that they put in there anyway that meaning basically if the guns are any good, they're supposed to be auctioned off. So out of 1,926 guns in 2013 that were collected, 244 were auctioned off as per state statute. 121 were departmental transfers, and I assume they use those for, you know, undercover. Well, I don't know. There's probably some of them there. They're actually the same models as what they're issued. 1,849 guns were destroyed against state statute. Now, what do they do? Do they go throw people in jail, throw the mayor in jail or whatever? You know, see the cops? What do they do? Well, apparently, all they're going to do is, and they're only threatening them with it. The last I heard, nothing like this has happened yet. But $177 million in shared revenue, Tucson risks losing this. 2014, 1,700 guns collected, 1,300 of them were destroyed, 99 were auctioned off as per state statute. 2015, 1,600 collected, 21 auctioned off, 21 were auctioned off as per the law. 538 of them destroyed, 59 of them were departmental transfers, and apparently there's still 1,000 that they haven't done anything with. I don't know what they're doing with those. 2016, as of October of 2016, there was almost 1,400 guns collected, 49 of them auctioned off, 84 departmental transfers, 1,128 destroyed. So in 4 years, there was 13, 18, 19, 20, 3,000. There was almost exactly 3,000 guns destroyed. If this is a vindictive thing by the city of Tucson, it costs money to destroy guns. Whether they're melted down, you pay labor, you pay fuel, you pay disposal, however you get rid of them, all this costs money. To auction those guns off, you make money. How stupid do you have to be not to understand that you make money on the one hand, you spend money on the other hand just to prove a point? 3,000 guns. Now there'll be some labor involved in, you know, getting these guns all inventoried, but they're going to be the same amount of labor is going to be spent in the inventory, the background checks, you know, cleaning them up, whatever they do to them, all that, whether they get rid of them or not, all that's going to be pretty much, probably a wash, pretty much the same. But that's where it ends, because they're going to, you know, the fuel, the transport, and everything else to destroy them. Or 3,000 guns at, say, an average of, they said some of these guns were in the, they said that some of them as high as $10,000 worth value. So let's take an average here. We know there was at least one gun. It said some. Let's see. Here we go right here. I filed a public records request with the city of Tucson to obtain all records related to the destruction of firearms that had significant market value, some of which had significant collectible value in excess of $10,000. So let's say out of 3,000 guns, some of them is higher than $10,000, other ones probably $100. So what can we say? On the average, those guns, $800. Let's say $500. So if they took those guns and decided to just sell them after they, you know, they paid their labor and all that, we're looking at $1.5 million just using $500 as a pull it out of midair average. Looking at $1.5 million that they could have made on this, as opposed to spending a few thousand dollars. I don't know, maybe $100,000. I don't know what they spent. But it damn sure wasn't free, I can tell you that. And to tinker, you know, nobody knows that. How many of these guns were sold to illegals and cartels? I have little doubt that some of them were. So let's move along. We're looking at all levels here. I thought about that too, to think around use his drop guns. I hate to even think of that, but we're gonna talk about that in a minute. Remember, I believe it was sometime last week we talked about Baltimore, where cops were using had on in their possession toy guns that they were planting on people that they shot accidentally or that they murdered. Well, we remember Dan Love, right? What more corrupt, low-life communist individual brutal, heartless. I can't even think of all the adjectives I'd like to come up for him. He was responsible for a number of deaths. Most notably was Dr. Red up in Blanding, Utah. Destroyed that entire family over some arrowheads and stuff. Admittedly, Dr. Red was in the wrong with what he was doing with these artifacts and stuff. But they, instead of just doing what normal cops do, they tormented him and his family, and it finally drove him to the point of suicide. Well, after a number of years, quite a number of years, Dan Love was finally stripped of his BLM hood, and he did manage to collect his retirement when he should have been put in jail in general population. Well, one of his proteges guy named William Woody. He was the BLM law enforcement director. He followed the path. Dan Love was his mentor in when he was first started with all this. And so it looks like, and I want to think this is because Trump's draining the swamp. I want to think that maybe there is some what the hell, I was reading the chat room there, and maybe there's some accountability happening here. Maybe the people are just starting to become a little concerned for their careers or for their freedom or both. Because this probably would not have happened 10 years ago. But Director Woody, let's see, Woody's abuses are numerous and broad in scope. Whose investigated allegations that BLM officials was not authorized to use government-owned vehicle for home-to-work commuting, traveling to his home state for personal reasons under the guise of work trips, inappropriately interfering with the hiring action of to select a lesser qualified applicant, and plan to relocate a BLM office to another state to personally benefit from the move. Misuse of a government vehicle while working in D.C., fraud in moving a major BLM office of law enforcement headquarters to Salt Lake, where Woody's wife's family lives. In a backroom compromise with Secretary Zinke upon Director Woody's removal from the FWS, was that Fish and Wildlife Service, man? Director Woody was told he could uproot his entire staff and move it to Salt Lake City, all expenses paid by the taxpayers. Overruling a senior law enforcement official on a hiring decision for Reno so he could bring in a female with whom he reportedly had a relationship. Illegal hiring a female staffer at a top federal pay grade to handle his public relations disasters. Hiring Dan Love and promoting him following his actions related to Operation Cerberus, which led to the deaths of three men in the Four Corners area. One of those was Dr. Red. Shielding Dan Love and covering up his insane expenditures, including $14,000 in vehicle modifications. BLM has a $2,500 limit. And extravagant and illegal purchases made for Operation Cerberus. It is reported that Woody helped Dan Love receive a medical retirement instead of being fired, which leaves the door open for Love to re-enter the agency at any time. Woody is known for extensive and unnecessary travel for meetings, often with large groups, and visits to sportsman shows and other unofficial activities. Despite a period of hiring freezes in government agencies, Woody continued to hire cronies at exorbitant salaries. Most people in his position get one GS-15, which is the highest pay grade available for federal employees. Woody reportedly buys the loyalty and silence of his agency underlings with unwarranted promotions and fat salaries. According to our informant, he is in the process of upgrading all his 60-odd investigators from GS-12 to GS-13s. With their special salary rate included, that's a $17,347 raise per person per year. He also promoted 15 or more supervisory investigators, all earning $128,822 a year as GS-14s, which gave them a $19,817 raise. And two additional GS-15s, which received $22,718 raise, which equates to an expenditure of $1,383,511 in taxpayer money spent every year. So that's just one man. Is there anybody out there that thinks that this hasn't happened in small sheriff's departments or state police offices or mayor's offices or whatever? We've seen this over and over and over and over and over. Once in a great while, they throw us a bone and somebody gets in a little bit of trouble. Generally, that little bit of trouble means they get transferred to another office with a raise. DeTinker, what about the gun that LaVoy had inside his pocket of his jacket?
Well, boy, that's a tough one. The gun was LaVoy's. It was the one that his son gave him, Mitch. I think he's Mitch. So that part was legitimate. So I have to wonder where they got it. Was it actually in his pocket? I seriously doubt that. But that's only because I know LaVoy. And I can't prove that it wasn't. But I can also say that it could have very easily been in his truck. Nobody knows. Nobody will ever know, probably. But it was his gun. So that's just to answer your question.
So let's move on along here and look at, you know, we've talked about jackbooted thugs and this kind of thing happening, you know, for years. I'm gonna save that one for the very end. Here was a veteran that died in police custody, and when he was returned to his family, he had some organs missing. Okay, now, during the autopsy, I understand that they may have taken some parts and pieces out and laid them aside, and they didn't get put back in for whatever reason. But instead of, if that would have been the case, I would have thought that they would have, you know, owned up to us. Oh, gee, we are so sorry. I cannot imagine, got those parts mixed up with other parts and they were incinerated or whatever. But this family has gone through hell for 2 or 3 years. Trying, number one, to get the body returned. When they finally got it, it wasn't complete. Now, when we say police custody, yeah, he was in a jail. That was police custody. He wasn't in the custody, in the immediate care of law enforcement officers. He was in a correctional facility. But in that facility, he died somehow.
So I won't go through the whole story. You can look it up. But the guy's name was Everett Palmer Jr. You can look this up. There's lots of evidence out there on it. And in this particular case, I understand that it wasn't the immediate law enforcement agents, the cops' problem here. But why he was arrested and why he wound up in that jail and everything was kind of their problem. They're doing. This guy showed up. He came from another state, and he said, you know, as long as I'm here, before I get in trouble, because when I was here, you know, before I got in trouble for DWI, I need to go down and make that right. And he tried to do that, was arrested, and ultimately wound up dying. There was another one here. Let's see. We heard about the off-duty LAPD officer that shot the guy in Costco the other day. That may have been perfectly legitimate. We'll talk about that some other time. But there is another one here. You heard about all the ATF, all the guns being stolen from their facility. We talked about that the other day, I believe. I have another one, though. Just stand by for just a minute. I'll find it. And I didn't find it yet, but I'm still looking. Anyhow, what it amounted to was I saw it here earlier. Anyway, it was about cops that shot a guy 55 times. Okay, without going through the I kind of understand how this could have happened.
There were, seems like I can't find the story, but if I remember right, there was at least six cops and maybe nine. I think there was six. So it meant that each one fired an average of, nine times? Not all the rounds hit him, obviously. Since I can't find the story, I can't get as deep into that as I wanted to. I can say that in the heat of stuff going on like that, when somebody starts shooting, this was the same reason that so many shots were fired at Lavoie. That's the reason I firmly believe that that's the reason that the FBI agent, what was his name, Astorita or something like that, Astorita, fired the first round. Because when that first real live round fired, of course, there was a lot of CS plastic bullets, you know, fired prior to that. But when he fired the first real round, if I'm not mistaken, he fired, I don't remember how many he fired. I know he fired once. I believe that that was the catalyst that started the firing. And why that cop shot Lavoie three times in the back, I'll have no, with a .223, I have no idea. But In the heat of stuff like this happening, where, you know, you take the adrenaline into account and all this stuff, I can see how that could happen. If there was at least six cops there and each of them fired nine times, I would say that that shows a little bit of restraint, even if it was unintentional, because those magazines probably held at least 12 rounds and probably 15 to 17. So that was, like I said, I can't place that one exactly in what I wanted to do because of the lost the story. But that's the funny thing about on Facebook Messenger. I save a lot of stories to Facebook Messenger, and then I go back and pull them up and put them in order before the show. But then for some reason, it only goes back now about six stories. Usually I can go back and pull stuff up from 2003. Like about 80,000 stories here I can go back and find them. But now it's not. And I don't know if it's just a glitch and they'll come back or what happened. But I lost a lot of my stuff. So let's finish this up. We're just about out of time. So let me finish it up with this one right here. This one takes the cake. This is the grand poobah of our stories tonight. This is about a sheriff in Sparta, Tennessee. Thanks to body cams, or we probably would have never known. Said they, after this was released here, and originally they thought this killing may was justified. They killed a guy named Michael Dial. In spite of him being unarmed, they figured it was justified. And I know how that happens. There are times when you're justified in shooting somebody that's unarmed. We go through that in our classes in excruciating detail. But new body cam footage has come up, has raised some serious questions. Now, these questions should have already, as far as I'm concerned, had this sheriff locked up. Last April, Smithville, Tennessee, police pulled this guy over for driving on a suspended license. Driving on a suspended license, just in case you didn't hear me. That's what his crime was, driving on a suspended license. A few minutes later, he was dead. All over driving on a suspended license. He was driving a 1976 pickup truck. When police turned the lights on, pulled him over, instead of stopping, he kept driving. Low-speed chase lasted only a few minutes before they rammed him off-road, shot him in the head. Unarmed, shot him in the head, posed no threat other than not stopping the vehicle. I understand how a vehicle can be deemed as a deadly weapon. However, they'd already pushed him off-road, he was stopped, and they were out of their vehicles, and he posed no threat at that point. His wife said that her husband was scared of the police, and rightfully so. This is what happened. So he chose to keep driving. Why didn't he stop? She said he was scared. I know him enough to know that. He never broke the speed limit, and aside from failing to stop, all he did was drive on a suspended license. Every dangerous, hostile action that happened was initiated by the police. The Tennessee Bureau of Investigation said, "How fast do you think he got up to?" And the detective said, "We might have got up to 50 at one point, but for the most part it was 30, 40 miles an hour." According to the Channel 5 News, it unfolded something like this, that the cab deputies backed off at the county line and White County took over. Their deputies tried to stop him using their patrol cars. Reserve Deputy Adam West got involved, driving his personal pickup. Sheriff Shoup was not involved in the chase, but he gave orders to the radio dispatcher authorizing deputies to shoot him, to shoot Michael Dial. Over the radio, we can hear the dispatcher relaying the command to kill the unarmed man over his suspended license. To kill the unarmed man over his suspended license. Per 59 is the sheriff, what they call the sheriff. Use deadly force if necessary. Take the subject out by any means necessary. This is what the sheriff said on the radio. A little bit after giving that command to kill him,
Police managed to cause him to spin out, at which point the deputy and an officer obeyed the sheriff, got out of their vehicles and executed him, shot him in the head. So not only is the sheriff ultimately 100% to blame here for this happening, but these deputies, this deputy and this other officer, are, is this not like the Nuremberg trials where they're just following orders? Wife said, I feel with every part of me that's exactly what they wanted to do was kill him. And she was right. They were ordered to. They were ordered to kill him. They didn't say to take him out. You know, you have permission to shoot him if he gets out of hand, but, you know, try to get him stopped, get him out of the truck. No, they just walked up and shot him in the head. Said new body cam footage was found showing just how much police wanted to kill him. The lawsuit now exposes the chilling conversation the sheriff had with the cops after they killed an unarmed man. One of the deputies who killed him was badly shaken up and appeared to be questioning the fact that he listened to the sheriff to take his life. Sheriff said, I told him, I said, take him out. Deputy said, I heard. Sheriff said, damn, I don't give a crap. It's not what he said, but that's what he said. The deputy said, it wasn't long after I heard shots fired. The sheriff said, lawsuit claims sheriff preferred to shoot and kill Mr. Dial rather than risk damaging his patrol cars. I'm going to have to paraphrase this just a little bit because of the language. But the sheriff said, they said, we're ramming him. I said, don't ram him, shoot him. Damn that, it ain't tearing up my cars. He said, if they don't think I'll give the damn order to kill that MF-er, they're full of crap. A little bit of laughter after that. Take him out. I'm here on the damn wrong end of the county. Indicating that he was sad that he missed the chance to murder this unarmed man. And I'm going to read this quote exactly as it is written. He said, I love this shit. God, I tell you what, I thrive on it. Dial's attorney said, is now calling the officers for killing, calling them out for killing an unarmed man, and drawing much needed attention to a cop that would thrive on taking a life. I don't know how you can thrive on taking a life. That's not law enforcement. It's that mentality of the highest policymaker in the county that's scary. So there you have it. They could have shot the tires, and so he was driving on a suspended. So what? He's got to stop sooner or later. Go to his house. This is what they could have done to Branch Davidian guy. They could have waited. They could have picked him up in Waco when he went to the ice cream shop. There's a lot of things they could have done, but they had to go make this big show of force and make a big deal out of something that was not a big deal. He was driving on a suspended license. So he was driving on a suspended license. So what? This has turned into... I can't even come up with a term for it. But the idea here, I know we're running a little bit over time, but I should have prefaced this show with this statement. I am 100% in support of the institution of law enforcement. I am not in 100% support of 100% of the participants of this institution.
I think that at least city, state, and county law enforcement to some degree. Well, let me back off from that a little bit. I can live with that. I'm not convinced it's 100% constitutional. The only thing that I know is constitutional is the sheriff. David Koresh, thank you. But we're not going to snap our fingers and make them go away. We can talk to our legislators. We can do whatever. We can start a wall-eyed fit rebellion and get them out by force. We can do whatever, but it's not going to happen right now. We are still making every effort to exhaust peaceful alternatives. I'd say that is almost been used up. If I was out on the highway or in town and found a cop coming under fire, I would not be able to get there fast enough to help him. I can stand here and tell you with not being in the situation right at this moment, but I can tell you that I would have every intention, if it came down to that, to, would I, you know, run out there and beat my chest and take a bullet for the cop? Well, that's a little bit of a stretch for anybody to say that they would do that. If I had the opportunity to carry the cop to safety or get him undercover, push him somewhere and wound up getting shot, that's part of the deal. In saying that, I guess I could make a long story short and say, yes, I would take a bullet for a cop that was under fire. I would risk whatever it took to help him. It's not the cops in general that I don't like. It's dirty cops, crooked cops, corrupt thieves, liars, murderers, jackbooted thugs that I absolutely despise. If I knew beyond any shadow of a doubt that the cop under fire was one that had, let's say, Dan Love. Would I help Dan Love if he was under fire? No, I would not. I wouldn't help the other side either. I'd just walk away. I see nothing. But the average cop and those that I don't know, those that I do know, I know some, especially here in Sholo, that are more constitutional than most people that I know. I know a cop here, or he was a cop here, he's not now, he ran for a higher office at some point and didn't get it. But he would not give tickets for either seat belts, helmets, or car seats. Said they were unconstitutional. I know another cop here that stopped a guy at 3 o'clock in the morning that was going 70 miles an hour through downtown Pine Top. And he stopped him, pulled him over, and said, told him, what's your hurry? And I'm not going to go into detail as to what that reason was. But the cop said, well, I understand. He said, be careful. Get on home and take care of it. There are good cops out there. There are cops out there that are amazingly good. But as time wears on, we get more and more and more that are just like Dan Love, that are just like this sheriff here says, I thrive on this. I love this stuff. Those people in that county need to get their ducks in a row. Something needs to happen out there. And I'll tell you the truth, something should have already happened out there. Something should have happened as soon as this story saw the light of day. So I, for one, am incredibly frustrated, disgusted, tired of this kind of stuff that's going on here. And nothing, what frustrates me is not that it's anything new. I mean, what's new is the fact that we have electronic surveillance and video and stuff, you know, to be able to bring this stuff into the public eye, which we didn't used to have. We, you know, we can be certain that stuff like this has gone on for a great long time. Particularly down in the southern states. But there was no way to prove it or document it at the time. So most of it got away largely unnoticed. That was one of those shoot them and drag them inside type affairs where there just wasn't anybody anywhere to dispute it. So anyway, that's I know I bounced around a lot. I've just kind of had a lot of stuff on my mind here the last few weeks, few months maybe. And I know I went from one end to the other here quite a bit. There's two more things. I'm way over time, so it's not going to make any difference if I tell you these other two stories. This is something else that we talked about, a week ago or so, about holding our children hostage, about using our children as political tools to further an agenda. Here is a kid. Remember all the ones we talked about, you know, blurring the hat? We've talked about a half a dozen of them just in the last two or three shows. Well, here is a, I don't have to play the video, but there's a girl here that was kicked out of class for saying that there's two genders. Now, you know, maybe the teacher's a retard and all the rest of the kids are retards right along with him. I can see that they don't agree. But kick him out of class just for telling the truth, telling you by telling something that is true, factual, and verifiable. In another case, Harvard rescinds their offer to a guy that who is a pro-Second Amendment Parkland survivor. Due to some of his remarks in the past. It said that Harvard rescinded his admission after the recent resurfacing of years-old remarks he called offensive, idiotic, and inflammatory, but composed before the mass shooting, which he says made him a different person. The 18-year-old revealed the rescindment on Twitter on Monday, along with screenshots of letters that appeared to be written on Harvard letterhead. He also detailed the steps he says he took to right this wrong with the school, which he had planned to attend in 2020 after taking a rest for a year. But there's more to the story, but the crux of the story is that because of remarks that he made prior to the shooting ever even happening, that his enrollment in Harvard has been rescinded. So, there you have it. There's my little rant for the night, and I go through these little spells from time to time and feel like I need to
feel like I need to share it, so I shared it. And that's going to be it, and I've got some things, got some good news, got several gun things to talk about on Wednesday. And kind of turning the tide here a little bit on some of the things we're doing on the show, so I'll share that with you later. But as for right now, I think I'm going to get out of here, and I appreciate y'all sitting with me, listening to me blow off a little steam tonight. And I'll talk to you Wednesday. Good night.
Well, that wraps up another edition of The Shooting Bench. Join me Monday and Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific, and again on Fridays from 7 to 10 for The Shooting Bench. Good night, and thanks for joining me.
No reconciliation. Talk it over, number I can call. Goodbye says it all.